The section this afternoon is devoted to the diehards, or those who want to get the full value of the money spent on the conference. Over the last, I'd say, about 10 years, there's been an increase in the number of programs with administrators. And by administrators, I mean people who are actually responsible for the program, as opposed to an old tradition of saying that a faculty member was responsible for the program, and the faculty member generally did no more than hire the people and turn them loose. That was the old librarian model, where the librarian, who was already overtaxed, had to hire the people and was supposed to oversee all of the third-year students who were going to be running the program. It was just an impossible task. Well, now, over the last few years, programs have begun to develop administrators who actually are faculty members who have came up through the program, originally began by teaching it, or have a truly strong interest in the program and want to do more than just hire people and sign timesheets so that they can get paid. This afternoon's program is going to deal with a rather diverse set of topics. We are going to have Christina Kunz talking about the administrator as a teacher of legal writing faculty, because that is a role that has been adopted by a number of people, particularly where you use adjuncts or where you use students. It becomes important not to be the kind of administrator who just turned them loose and let them practice their version of legal writing on unsuspecting students. Marge Rombauer is going to address a topic that's rather important to all of us who are, or those of you who are on tenure track, and the question of scholarship, which is an obviously important area in any university setting, because your tenure is going to rely in part upon scholarship. And traditionally, there have been models that relied on scholarship in a doctrinal area having nothing to do with what you were doing in legal writing. So Marge will talk about scholarship, and then we'll skip over what I'm going to do. And Millard is going to present for us some rather interesting statistical information that has been gathered recently on the resource base for legal writing programs. Since you have biographies in the book itself, I won't go over them with you. One of the things that does not appear in the biography about Christina Kunz is that she has a book which will be coming out shortly with Little Brown. Christina?
Thank you. I've placed an outline on the tables in front of you, and I can always say I'll track it closely, but I'll probably diverge at many instances. Firstly, let me explain what sort of program I'm in just briefly. I won't do the typical 10-minute recitation, but I think it helps to understand what sort of situation we have at William Mitchell, to understand how our program evolved and also how we came to some of the alternatives that I list. And this outline is meant to be not only an outline of the speech, but also a list of all the different alternatives you can use to staff and run your program. And believe me, we've tried more than a few of them. I have strong opinions on some of them, and others I will just leave up to you, because it depends on the process that Laurel outlined this morning. And I have to admit that a portion of my outline went sort of poof at that point. This process I've left on the board because this is exactly the regular goal type of process that you have to use before you even decide how to administer and coordinate and set up your course. And a lot of how you choose to staff your course will depend on these curricular outlines. Firstly, though, let me explain what we've got at Mitchell. We've got a student body of about 330 down to 300 students. It varies from year to year. Faculty ranging in legal writing between 25 and 27 people. It's big. Two of us are coordinators on the full-time faculty, tenure track. We also teach other courses, but we were hired for our legal writing ability, and we work together fairly well by this time, having worked together for 3 years. There is a third person in the course who is on a year sabbatical from legal writing. He's been teaching for 7 years, and so have I, but he got the first year off because he's not tenured yet, and I am, so I stayed on. I get a year off somewhere around here, and he will rotate in so that we have a group of coordinators who will hopefully not burn out, and I think that's a wonderful idea if you have the resources. We all have strengths in other areas for substantive courses, and we're needed on those courses. It's not just a token assignment. For instance, my contracts and commercial transactions assignments are vital to the curriculum, which helps me be a part of the mainstream of the faculty. We also, in addition to the two of the coordinators, have two or three full-time faculty who are rotating through the course on a yearly basis. So we have a total of 7 full-time faculty now, in addition to the 3 of us, who are trained in teaching legal writing at the first-year level. We think that talent pool is going to be invaluable as we start to move into the upper-level writing courses, because we have fully a third of our faculty already trained, and we'll have a half within a year or two, who know classic methods of teaching, grading, running legal writing courses, having been through the course and watched it be administered from our level. The administrative and the faculty support for legal writing at Mitchell is very good. I can explain this on a couple different levels. One, we don't have any separation between skills and substantive training faculty. There are a lot of faculty who teach both substantive and skills courses. Mitchell has a clinical program that is nationally known, got the Emil Gumpert Award a couple years ago for excellence in trial advocacy. We win the client counseling competition and trial advocacy competitions every once in a while, trial ad on a regular basis. And so the skills training programs, including legal writing, have been widely accepted and supported by the faculty and by the administration. And that gives us a financial base to operate off of, and we're not in danger of losing that. If we got a dean who was opposed to that, I think the faculty would get rid of him. And that's a nice feeling of support. I was concerned about that when I got on board, and we have just finished a dean search this spring, and the same concerns came up. And as I polled my colleagues, they said, well, if there were a dean who had that sort of attitude against legal writing, he wouldn't be tolerated, and he certainly wouldn't win. So we're in stable circumstances, and in some part I don't think that you can change all schools in that direction, but sometimes you can move to a school that is going in that direction, which is nice. And having the clinical faculty around has given us a lot of ideas on how to administer the course, and truly we have borrowed or at least tried some of their ideas. Okay, so starting out, the first task is to do these curricular type goals. You've got to figure out exactly what types of writing assignments you want to have. If there's some flexibility there, leave in all the alternatives, because you may need to use one or the other when you get down to the nitty-gritty of the realities of life. And you should also decide on your teaching goals and exactly what your teaching theories are behind the course to make sure that all of them can be adequately implemented by the type of staffing configuration you choose. For instance, if you need a practice background, students will not be an option. If you want somebody who can convey the real-world context of legal writing, then students are not acceptable. If you want, for instance, more of an academic slant and people with a more traditional sort of substantive view that they can infuse into the writing, then full-time faculty may be a better choice. Think about the slant that you want your teachers to give the course, because when you hire, they will come to the hiring situation with predispositions that you cannot change markedly. They will still have their perspective on legal writing, and you need to hire for that perspective, but you can't always train them in your mold. Your options for hiring writing faculty include a couple. We use practicing attorneys for the most part. We have 22 practicing attorneys with the program currently. About two-thirds of them have been with the program for at least 2 years. We get about one-third turnover every year. We have found from experience they should be at least 2 years past graduation. Otherwise, they're still in that dichotomy of, am I a student or am I an attorney? They're in new jobs, so their workloads are ferocious, and they're not able to adequately judge what they can juggle. That relates to the last point. Be especially cautious about hiring anybody who's concurrently starting a new job, no matter what year out of law school they are in. For some reason, litigators love to teach, and you will get applications by the dozen, and they will be terrific in interviews, and most of the time they will be wonderful in the classroom. They are performers. That's why they're litigators. And we've had very good luck with litigators. The cautions, two cautions I have is, firstly, be sure to diversify your faculty. You don't just want litigators, because they will give you a litigation-prone course instead of bringing in things like alternative dispute resolution methods and things like that. And also, their schedules are volatile, and you will end up picking up some of their classes for them. That's okay. But just be cautious about that so that you know that that problem is existing. We've had very good luck with and this has been all women, attorneys who are on part-time or new parent leaves. They want to keep their hand in the legal field, but they want a predictable schedule. Their firm won't let them come in 1 or 2 days a week, and so these people have been applying to us in greater and greater numbers in the last couple of years, and they are wonderful because the time and attention they give to the course is truly terrific. They usually only stay for a year or two, but that's okay because the quality you get out of them in that time is really good, and they're very trainable. They're not rushed in other portions of their lives. We also have one judge on our faculty who's been there for 6 years. He's fine. I've got cautions about judges. We interviewed one last summer who we didn't hire because we didn't feel we could control him. He was a very strong person who had very particular views and did not seem to be particularly receptive to views in the alternative to his. And so we did not hire him on that basis, even though his credentials were wonderful. You need to think about that. Power battles do develop, and you don't want somebody who is inflexible towards your views as well as inflexible to good ideas that the students have. But the one judge we've had for 6 years has been terrific, and he gives students a real sense of audience, because he is the audience they will be writing to in large part. On students, I have very little experience. I asked around to some people who use student staffing, and I want to present the alternatives, but I think that it's probably best to draw on people who have the experience for guidelines in this area. Some schools use LLM candidates, and that's a nice method of staffing, especially if they will stay around for 2 years, because you can at least get the 50% turnover rate instead of 100%. The level of expertise and the training is fairly good with those candidates, and I understand that those programs work well. Senior instructors, senior students, work well, and some schools call these people mentors in order to put them in the advisory role rather than the sort of answer person role, and I think that's probably a good idea in terms of vocabulary, but you can structure that how you need to. Another alternative is to use senior instructors with junior teaching assistants who then move on to become the senior teachers the next year. So there again, you get only about a 50% turnover, and you get some self-training because you have a mentor-mentee relationship between the senior and junior students, and that kind of interrelationship, I think, helps your training load that you would otherwise have. Another alternative that Ralph mentioned is student teaching assistants who are assigned to the other teachers, be they adjuncts or full-time faculty. Also, you can have a system where you have student instructors who then are assigned to full-time faculty, who then are coordinated by someone at the top. So it's a three-level hierarchy. And I have heard from, I think, Kathy, do you still use that at Minnesota? The three-level, the three-tier level? That's the Minnesota system, and of course we have a lot of interaction with the University of Minnesota. In fact, one of the nicest pools of practicing attorneys to hire are the folks who were their instructors in the third year of law school, now come to Mitchell after 2 years of practice and apply to be a full-time or be an adjunct practicing attorney, and they already have a year of teaching experience behind them. Very good pool in terms of experience. On full-time faculty, I'm sure you know all the alternatives. There are one-year contracts, two-year contracts. There are the long-term clinical contracts, tenure track, or tenured faculty. I think the only important thing there is that there are trade-offs on each of those choices, and of course with the shorter term there are a lot of long-term and hidden costs, but there are plenty of debates about that. You can have them with or without other teaching responsibilities, and I would include in this group also the specialists such as librarians and the English PhD people. So any combination of the above or a single group or so on, whatever meets your needs. Now, other than your curricular needs, you've got some needs in terms of just the realities. And I think, firstly, that you should look at how you're going to set up your coordinators. What do you have available in terms of a coordinator pool? If there's only one coordinator, you do not want 22 legal writing faculty. It can't be done. You will go crazy in a couple years. And just because you think you can tough it out doesn't mean that it's a good career choice for you or for the school. So do not choose a proliferation of faculty if there's only going to be one coordinator. From experience, we think that the best number is two. We tried three co-coordinators for 1 year, and three years. We had three people for 3 years, and we had so many meetings that when we dropped down to two, it was just about the same amount of time spent because we had more adjuncts to supervise, but we had fewer meetings. And I think Deb and I have both decided we prefer two instead of three, but definitely two instead of one because one person alone needs some backup support. In addition, you should look at things like the peak faculty workload for a week. And I would include in that things like how many conferences you want them to hold. Do you want them to be readily accessible during the week or two before the assignment is due? How accessible do they need to be? Do they need to return phone calls within 24 hours, which is our standard? Or do they need to be available on demand in the building, in which case students may be a very good idea and so may full-time faculty? What are the possible class meeting times? Do you run into room crunches, or do you have other types of difficulties in terms of the times that, for instance, practicing attorneys are available? To this day, Mitchell can't hold more than one out of four large sections of legal writing. We have the freshman classes divided into quarters, and only one of those sections can be a day section for legal writing purposes. The other day section we hold at 4:30, the end of the sort of, you know, work day for those day students, and then the remaining two evening sections are, of course, easy to staff. But we can't get enough attorneys who are available during the day to be able to staff two 12:30 or 2:30 classes. Budget constraints, of course, are probably the major real-world reality. We pay $1,000 per credit right now. I don't know what the figures are at other schools. We still get a lot of griping from the adjuncts, but there's no chance of the administration ever okaying more money than that because they have a faculty of 150 part-time instructors, and that would change the pay scale for everybody else. So we're going to stay at 1,000 per credit hour. How available is the cream of the crop? If you want to get students, will the best students be available? Or, in other words, can you lure them away from the clerkships that they're likely to engage in? Can you lure them away from law review? Can they balance law review and teaching legal writing? Will you only be able to get the second or third tier of that particular group? I think those are important considerations. In the practicing attorneys, we haven't had any trouble because we're not having any competition on the market. But, for instance, if University of Minnesota or if Hamline, the other two schools in town, shifted over to using practicing attorneys, we would have a harder time getting the cream of the crop out of that teaching pool. And I think that's an important consideration for what you're competing for on the market. Here's a big one. How much resources do you have to train new faculty each year? In other words, what kind of turnover can you stand? What's the bottom line in terms of turnover? Now, we estimate a third of our faculty were turnover each year because the average burnout rate for practicing attorneys is about a third of them each year. But one year we had a mass exodus of half. The entire civil litigation division of the Attorney General's office decided they had had it with teaching legal writing after two or three years, and they all decided to leave. And, you know, you take your lumps when you hire in one sector like that, but they were good, and that was okay. But then we had a 50% training rate that year, retraining rate, instead of only the 33%. So look at the resources that it takes, and make your staffing configuration choice on the fact of whether you can do that year after year after year after year, not just next year or the next. And lastly, are any of these choices for staffing politically unacceptable? You know the realities in your school. Is your full-time faculty going to scream bloody murder over student staffing or over attorney staffing? Or are they going to complain even more bitterly about themselves being brought into the program to be part of the writing faculty? Will there be other difficulties in obtaining the sort of standardization that you want with any of those choices? For instance, if you're an untenured or even non-tenure-track faculty member, how likely is it that you're going to be able to standardize your course and curricular goals over tenure-track and tenured full-time faculty? The realities are very tough. There are a lot of times when you get squeezed on that, and I think you want to look at those political realities before you choose. We have some strong feelings about some of these. For instance, having tried it once, I say with a great deal of emphasis, do not choose a staffing configuration that splits up the teaching and grading responsibilities. We tried it once. The results are abysmal. The reason that people do this is that they don't trust their faculty, their teaching faculty. And so they keep the big classes to themselves, and they hold an introductory lecture, and then they have the rest of their faculty go out and do the little follow-up lectures and the grading and the conferences and stuff like that. If you can teach it, you can teach someone else to teach it, and if you split up those grading and teaching responsibilities, you will always have students playing the two of you against the middle, their instructor and you. And the person who gives the grade, not the person who ranks higher, is the person who will win. And you, if you're the one giving those large lectures and you're the coordinator, will get horrible class evaluations because the students perceive the splits and perceive the differences of opinion, and they don't believe you. You lose the credibility. So please do not do this, just from really hard experience my first year at Mitchell. Small tutorial classes are wonderful if you can manage to staff them. I think the three of us are absolutely convinced. By the way, the third member of the teaching staff came from here at Chicago Kent, which also had the tutorial method even when he came to us. And all three of us agree that the class size we have now at 12 or 13 is really terrific. If we could get it down to 10, we would, but, you know, I don't think there's much chance for that. But you can turn around papers faster, you can hold more conferences, you can get a nice participation rate in class. Politically, it's sometimes very tough in some schools, but if you want to know what I think is the ideal, I think that we've got it in terms of class size. If you're looking at the political realities, and I just wanted to say a couple things in here, of trying to get a better budget or staffing configuration for your program, you should look at the hidden costs that your school is incurring by trying to reinvent the wheel every couple of years. There are a lot of schools that have permanent legal writing committees from the faculty, or as Shirley mentioned this morning, schools that are every year bringing in an inquisition task force to take a look at the program and revamp it and find out what's wrong. Mitchell has no such committee, has not had one for the 5 years since I got there, and the number of administrative complaints that go up to the dean's office are exactly one a year. and every time I could wring the student's neck who makes it to the dean's office without getting to me. It's important to keep those things centralized in the legal writing department and not have them spilling out into the other areas of the school. And if your dean is balking at giving more money, you should point out, perhaps, that there's a lot of time and energy and grief that's taken by the dean's office and by the faculty in trying to keep a legal writing program afloat and resolve the complaints by the students, whereas at our school, that administrative load by the dean's office and the faculty committee are non-existent. There's a lot of politics here, admittedly. I hope if you're running into these problems that you'll use the people that you've met at this workshop as a networking source and draw on their expertise, because maybe some of us have an idea of how to get around some of those problems. And other times you have to leave gracefully and say, I won't work here. I know, easier said than done. The bottom line is that you should retain the control of the curriculum and the course. I think that taking a look at these types of goals is absolutely the first step. But the other step is that when you standardize the course, you should standardize it enough to affect what I've noted as the bottom line on the top of page 4, that the student's overall GPA or class rank should not be affected by their assignment to whichever legal writing faculty they ended up with. Now, and if it goes beyond that, I'm not going to standardize any further than that. It's not worth my while administratively to fine-tune down any further than this. But, for instance, on the schedule, I think it's important to standardize the number of assignments, the type of the assignments, the page, the difficulty, percentage weights given to the assignments, the timing, all sorts of things that would affect students' workload so as to make it harder or easier on them in legal writing. And that's the reason, I think, for standardizing the schedule and the syllabus. And I concur with Laurel here that a schedule of at least week-to-week goals is important.